Hi, this is Steve Poore, and you're listening to Pioneers and Pathfinders. Today's guests, Lisa Kolpoise and Mark Chandler, help lead the Filing Fairness Project at the Deborah L. Rohde Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford Law School. This project is an ambitious, multi-jurisdictional effort to modernize court filing systems, widen access to courts, and improve the administration of justice by leveraging readily available technology already used in other sectors. Mark was chief legal officer at Cisco for 20 years, leading it to become one of the most innovative legal departments in the world. After leaving the company, he teamed initially with Professor David Freeman Engstrom and Stanford Legal Design Lab leader Margaret Darren Hagen to tackle the gap between the sophisticated tools available in the corporate world and those used by legal aid organizations and self-represented litigants as they navigate the court system. Lisa Kolpoise, who had already been an experienced leader in legal aid for over two decades, joined the leadership team last spring. Lisa previously led Illinois Legal Aid Online and also worked at the Administrative Office of the Illinois Courts and as a consultant to the Michigan Supreme Court Justice for All Project. Today, Lisa and Mark discuss what led them to Stanford, the goals of the Filing Fairness Project, the biggest challenge the project has faced so far, and the need for additional court funding. I hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed having the conversation. Lisa, Mark, how are you? Thank you for joining.
Great. It's great to be here with you, Stephen.
Great to be here.
It's great to see both of you. Let's start. You're both partnering together with a team of great people on the Filing Fairness Project, sponsored through Stanford Law School. Before we talk about your journeys as to how you got to this particular point in your careers, let's talk a little bit about the Filing Fairness Project. What is it? What's its mission?
Well, I can take a second and describe where it came from. And then Lisa, who's just been an incredible treasure to work with for Stanford Law School and for this project, can elaborate. You know, I spent 20 years as chief legal officer at Cisco and was stunned, as I would do legal aid volunteer work with teams from my department and as a board member of a large legal aid organization, at the contrast between the tools that we'd been able to build internally to make everything faster, better, cheaper, and what folks who were dealing with really life-altering events like eviction and domestic violence, debt collection, the tools that they have to work with and which their lawyers at legal aid organizations would have to contend with. I mean, it was pathetic. It was like a march back into a different century, and I was never sure whether it was the 20th century or the 19th that I was walking back to. So when I left Cisco, I thought it would be great to figure out a way to help the courts do a better job at making it easy for people to access judicial relief or filings when they needed to. And I was lucky enough to connect with David Engstrom, the leader of the Rohde Center for the Legal Profession at Stanford. And out of that came the Filing Fairness Project that we taught a couple of classes 2 years ago and have taught a policy lab this past quarter and have had an ongoing project that Lisa is now helping to lead. So I'll leave it to Lisa to now describe exactly what we're doing.
Great. Thanks, Mark. So the Filing Fairness Project is really an ambitious, multi-jurisdictional effort to help courts modernize their forms and filing systems, ultimately to increase access to justice for all court users and to also improve the administration of justice and make courts more efficient. And in December, we launched a toolkit for court modernization. And the toolkit really is a guide for courts to help them, encourage them, motivate them on this journey to filing system modernization. We really think that the courts are a main part of the solution here. And the toolkit focuses on several areas, including filing technology infrastructure, filing partner ecosystems, technology governance, and forms and filing processes. And within each of those kind of pillars of the toolkit, we include recommendations, best practices, a maturity model so that courts can gauge where they sit from kind of good to or moderate to advanced as far as their journey in that particular area. We also have diagnostic tools so that courts can assess their level of maturity. Really, the idea behind the toolkit is that, and the ultimate vision is that court users will have an easy to use, seamless journey from the time that they recognize that they have a legal problem that they have to go to court for and they have to get into court. So one of the problems that we see over and over again, and this has to do specifically with electronic filing technology, is that people prepare their documents in different ways. They may use a PDF form, they may use pen and paper, or they may use a document assembly tool. And in any of those ways of preparing their forms, they need to access an e-filing system that is oftentimes not very user-friendly and difficult to manage. And when they use a document assembly tool, which we think is a very good way for people to prepare their forms because it breaks down the form into plain language and an easy workflow, when they use those types of systems, they're not connected to the e-filing system. And so users have to try to navigate multiple different technology systems and platforms just in order to file the forms they need to get into court and have their day. And so we are trying to motivate and encourage courts through this toolkit to modernize these systems so that everybody can use them. By the way, it also helps lawyers because it makes it easier for them too.
Well, it's always good to help the lawyers. It's a fabulous project and certainly one that's important and well needed, but I got bunches of questions, particularly relating around the change management issues that have to be embedded in this project. You know, as you describe it, it makes complete sense. But as I think all three of us know, just because something makes sense doesn't mean it's going to be reasonably accepted as people are asked to change their process. So let me start. Have you encountered resistance? I used to be a litigator and I used to litigate in state courts around the country. And I would come in and, you know, the big Chicago litigator, who are you to be telling me in my courtroom how this case ought to be tried? Have you encountered that? Oh, Stanford, you know, intellectuals, you don't know our problems here in X, Nebraska. Have you encountered resistance? I assume you've encountered resistance from the courts.
And I'll tell you, actually not. What we've done is tried to structure everything we've done in a way by listening. And so the starting point for this project and what our students did in the first year was actually reach out to courts around the country and figure out what everybody agreed on. And stunningly, there's really very little conflict between the courts and within courts about the need to make the system less opaque and less complex. The problem has been that every court has done it its own way to the point that you made about your experience in state courts. So this hasn't been an ivory tower intellectual project at all. We have six states that we've worked with, red and blue and purple, some folks in Virginia at the county level, Michigan, Texas, Kansas, Colorado, Alaska, and in addition, the Los Angeles Superior Court has teamed with us for a much larger project that we can talk about as well. And they all see the need to come up with a better way to operate the courts. They themselves see the inefficiency that they have from being tied to inconsistent systems that don't work with each other. The problem is getting them to talk to each other and agree really to a common set of standards. And I've got to give a huge shout out to the National Center for State Courts that's done a great job at trying to set some standards, which have been differentially adopted in different areas of court technology. So what we've tried to do with the toolkit is go after exactly what you describe, is create an easy way for courts to do the minimum, really, that would allow for a scalable, sensible tool to exist that would allow people to file more easily. There are always going to be differences between courts, differences between states based on statutory differences, but with a baseline of standardization, you can make it work across jurisdictions, just as TurboTax does with very different state tax systems. So very, very little resistance, actually. And to me, that was a starting point for this, was to make sure that we had a path of least resistance.
How do you deal, again, I got a bunch of questions. One, for courts, they don't necessarily have the biggest budgets in the world. And anytime you're talking about streamlining or increasing technology, there's an investment being made, certainly well worth it, but that still poses a barrier. How have you, I assume you've encountered that, and how have you helped courts make the case for budget investment from the state legislatures to accomplish this result? And then my next question will be, for the consumer, people use various, sort of picking up, Lisa, on the point you made, people access technology in different ways. Some people have only a mobile phone. Some people have a laptop. Some people, we saw the access to technology during COVID with school children. How do you deal with that gap?
So we can start with the funding question. Certainly, courts do have cash-strapped budgets, but more and more they are recognizing that they need to invest in this area. They spend a lot of money on e-filing systems, and many courts, especially the ones we're working with, recognize that they have a responsibility to serve all of their court users, not just lawyers. And so they are trying to find ways to, you know, come up with the budget for these types of projects. I will say there are opportunities here for funders who are interested in this area, who are interested in solving this access to justice problem, to invest in courts, because I think that would be a really sound investment. Courts are motivated and they want to do the right thing. So I think, you know, there's an opportunity for funders to really see an impact on their investments in this area. Mark, do you have anything to add there?
Stephen, you know, it's interesting. I've used an analogy that seems to have held up over time, which is in some ways court administrators are like the folks running an elephant show in a circus, and they need to make sure that the elephants are fed and the trainers are paid and the bleachers are clean. And there's a stool for the elephant to put its foot on and so forth. And if you tell them there are potholes in the road to get to the circus and some people can't get there, they all agree that's terrible. If you ask them that you need budget in order to go fix the potholes, they'll tell you, gee, they hardly have the money to keep the bleachers clean, let alone pay to fix potholes out in the road. That said, the things that we're trying to do are all things that the courts are doing already. Almost every state has some kind of e-filing system in place. They're just all different from each other, sometimes different from county to county, and that makes it impossible to build scalable tools. So what we're trying to get people to do is repurpose what they're doing already to a standardized approach so that you can have scalable tools that will work across jurisdictions that people can then invest in and maintain. There are hundreds of different projects going on to simplify court processes right now, but unfortunately, they're ill-funded. They don't get maintained and supported over time. They work only in one place or another. And what we're trying to do is make it very easy to standardize across jurisdictions. And the great part is that in the states we're working with, and we have several others who've approached us now, they all get it. So we don't think it's a big lift from a funding standpoint. But as Lisa pointed out, there are a lot of organizations that are in this space already willing to fund courts, and we're just trying to get them to focus on the easiest steps to do to get that kind of standardization. This is not a technology problem. This doesn't require buying a lot of new equipment. It's to some extent a people problem because folks don't like change. But as I said, most of the folks we work with are eager to do this. What it is more than anything else is a process issue. So when we get people on the same page on process, we can crack this nut.
Let me stick on the funding issue, Lisa, if I could. One of the byproducts of making it simpler and more straightforward and more access to ability to access the court system is potentially an increase in filings and an increase in the volume of plaintiffs coming through the system. Has anyone addressed the need for funding to increase the potential capacity for court? I mean, that's a good thing. People ought to be able to vindicate their rights, and we can all agree on that. But is there a concern that it places an extra burden on the volume on the courts that has to be addressed?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing, oftentimes part of court funding is through filing fees. So if there's more filings, there's more fees. And so that solves part of that problem. But if people are self-represented and they qualify for a fee waiver, yes, then there may be more people who are filing who qualify for a fee waiver and would require extra burden. But really, with the tools that we're promoting, we're increasing efficiency in the court system. So, you know, with these types of electronic filing systems that are connected with each other, there should be less work to be done on the court side, on the court clerk side, in order for this, seamless filing. And so courts can repurpose their staff. They won't need as many people at the front desk accepting paper filings, and they can repurpose them for other tasks and responsibilities.
In 3/4 of the civil cases in the country, at least one party doesn't have a lawyer, and the bounce rates on the filings are just extraordinary. And the clerks are very unhappy with the number of times they have to have people redo things. And we've interviewed judges as part of this project who've said that when people are using electronic tools, they get more accurate filings with more relevant information. And one of the problems with the pre-existing systems is that they don't find out what's really relevant until they have a hearing. People provide lots of information that isn't legally relevant. So we think these steps actually are a way to ease the court's load, not increase it.
How do you deal with the people's access to technology, which is widely variant?
Yeah. And most people who are, my experience from working in legal aid and working for the courts, is that most people who are self-represented, who are trying to navigate a court system on their own without a lawyer, their access to technology is largely limited to their phone. And, you know, most people have a smartphone or some type of a device these days that they can access the internet. And that's how they're trying to navigate these systems. And so in order to do that, courts need to be responsive and make sure that their systems are mobile friendly so that they are easy to use on a phone, so that people can prepare their, you know, it's not easy to pull up a PDF document on your phone and fill it out. But if you have a guided interview in plain language, it asks you questions one after another, and then in the background prepares the form for you that you can download, or even better yet, click a button and electronically file it. That's a process that one could do on their phone fairly easily. So those are the types of applications and systems that need to be in place in order to serve all court users.
Now, this is a project sponsored by the Rody Center in Stanford, if I've got that right. For our listeners who may not be that familiar with it, tell us what the center is and what its mission is and how this fits within the mission of the center.
Well, I'd like to start on that, but I'll go back to what Lisa was just saying and point out that, you know, we're not trying to boil the ocean here. The types of tools that we're talking about to help people with court filings are used ubiquitously across the economy in lots and lots of different spaces. It's just they haven't been able to be used in the courts because of the lack of scale and the fact that every court does things differently, or most do. So we see this as analogous to what goes on in a lot of the economy already. Not everyone will be able to use these tools, and that's okay. Legal aid organizations will benefit substantially. But the throughput that I saw volunteering at legal aid was so low compared to what we were able to accomplish in our company that tools that simplify things ought to make a big difference in legal aid effectiveness as well. The Rody Center focuses on improvements to the legal profession in a number of areas, a big part of which is access to justice, the space that this project fits into. Deborah Rody was my professional responsibility professor her first year teaching in 1979-80 at Stanford. And that class made a lifelong impression on me, and she became a lifelong friend. So for me, it's a tremendous pleasure to be helping to do this project under the auspices of the Rody Center, which is, of course, named in her memory. Lisa, maybe you want to run through a few of the other projects that are going on.
Yeah, I mean, other topics and issues that the Rody Center is tackling include re-regulation of the legal profession, transparency in litigation and multi-district litigation, legal profession diversity, lawyers' mental health, and digital transformation and access to justice. So, and, you know, the Filing Fairness Project falls under that digital transformation area. But the center, as Mark said, is really focused on making the civil justice system more equitable, accessible, and transparent.
Now, both of you come to this particular project from different career paths. And both have had long, illustrious careers in practice. You've taken different paths, though. Lisa, you've been in some form of legal aid or not-for-profit for most of your career. Mark, as you pointed out, you were GC and the top lawyer at Cisco for a good part of your career. Talk to me a little bit about your paths. Lisa, let's start with you. You started as a practicing lawyer for a few years, but then relatively early in your career went into legal aid, in particular legal aid focused on technology. What caused that turn?
You know, I wanted to work in legal aid right from the beginning. Unfortunately, when I graduated from law school, there was not a good market for legal aid, and jobs were few and far between. I did actually start working in legal aid in law school. Didn't expect to go into public service when I went to law school, but met somebody who changed my life. And I ended up working for this person at what was then called the AIDS Legal Council of Chicago, and wanted to follow that path. I diverted a little and practiced law for a little while, but I got back to it and started working at an organization called Carpals, which is a legal aid hotline, in the mid-90s, when a hotline and a telephone was an innovative way to deliver legal services. They were the first standalone legal aid hotline in the country and really deployed technology, the technology of the day, in a way that was innovative for legal services. So I stayed there for about 5 years, became the legal director, and then pivoted to a new startup organization called that became Illinois Legal Aid Online, which was a nonprofit collaboration of legal services who in 2001 could agree that they didn't know how to adopt and take advantage of the technology that was emerging around the turn of the century. And so the organization was formed and incubated at Chicago Kent Law School. And really our mission was to figure out how to use technology to serve people who could not afford a lawyer, but also to help serve and improve pro bono services. So to help lawyers do pro bono better and more efficiently, and to help train and support legal aid lawyers. And over many years, I was there for 17 years, we developed web tools, apps, triage systems, many things that in the world may not have been cutting edge, but in the delivery of legal services at the time were leading edge innovations.
It's interesting, isn't it? That point you just made, that technology may not be innovative in the world, but it is in the legal profession. That's certainly been my experience.
Yeah. I spent a lot of my time at Illinois Legal Aid Online looking at what things in the world, you know, how other industries were using technology and figuring out how we can do that.
We can learn a lot from other industries, can't we?
Yes, for sure.
So what brought you to Stanford?
So before I joined the team at Stanford last spring, I was working with the Illinois courts. And I was there for almost 3 years. I joined the team with the Administrative Office of the Illinois Courts to stand up a service called Illinois Court Help, which was a technology-enabled customer support platform for court users. People from all 102 counties of Illinois could call, text, chat, email with a trained court guide and get the information they needed to better navigate their court journey. One of the things that I learned in this role as we stood up the service and began to serve the people of Illinois was that the electronic filing system was what about half of them were contacting us about. But they were having problems managing and using the electronic filing system to get their day in court. And so I learned a whole lot about e-filing. And really, that's what led me to this work at Stanford when I saw this post about this time last year for the role that I'm in. I thought, wow, you know, this is really marrying all of my past experiences from, you know, a legal aid lawyer to working to develop technology solutions for self-represented people, lawyers and, you know, volunteers to trying to help people through electronic filing. It really married all of my past experiences and skills and seemed like a dream opportunity.
It certainly sounds like a dream opportunity. I'm jealous. Mark, how about you? Let's talk a little bit about your background. You spent a lot of your career at Cisco as being the head lawyer, and Cisco, under your guidance, became known as one of the most innovative, creative thinking legal organizations in the corporate world. Talk to us a little bit about that mindset. How did that develop over your career?
Well, the most important thing for Cisco's success in that space was for me to hire people who are smarter than I was in doing this, which most of my staff would agree was not a very high bar. They did an amazing job, though. And for me, I've always been fascinated with the problem of how do you make things work better? In fact, when I was in law school and taking Professor Rohde's class, I was frustrated by some things I found the State Bar of California doing that was making it a little bit harder for legal aid to do its job and get its funding and so forth. And I wrote an op-ed piece about it, which the Los Angeles Times ran. They wrote the headline. I didn't. The headline was, California State Bar Sticks It to the Poor. That was in 1980. I'm surprised the State Bar let me in, but I've now been a member for 43 years and they haven't kicked me out yet. As my career developed, I found I wasn't that interested in practicing law, but I had a job inside a company in a non-legal role that convinced me I loved being part of building things and making things. And when I was 32, I became general counsel of a publicly traded company called Maxtor that was in the disk drive business, and then eventually went from there to another company that Cisco acquired in 1996 and ended up spending, therefore, close to 33 years as a public company general counsel. I was in that role at Cisco for 20 years. And to what you were just saying to Lisa, you know, what we wanted to do was make sure that we were using the same tools in a legal organization that we were telling the rest of the world they should be using throughout their business operations. And so I focused a big chunk of my budget on making sure that we were automating and simplifying everything we could do inside a legal department. And as you noted, we got a lot of credit for doing that, but it wasn't really that much different than what was going on everyplace else. And over time, as a legal tech industry developed, we really started to have to focus on decommissioning our own tools because the market was starting to provide better tools for people to use throughout the profession. That's why it was such a pleasure to work with SafeArth on the implementation of tools to make your work simpler in the law firm. And, you know, I mentioned earlier when I retired in 2021, I wanted to focus on this problem that I'd seen volunteering at legal aid organizations. Within 2-3 weeks after retiring, I sat down for lunch with Ron Flagg, the current CEO, and Jim Sandman, the former CEO of the Legal Services Corporation, and said, you know, why is this such a mess? Why is it so hard for folks to work with legal aid or on their own to file these documents that they need to answer a debt collection complaint or an eviction complaint or to get a domestic violence restraining order? And they gave me a list of folks to talk to that said would help me understand that. That led to the project and to working with Professor Engstrom at Stanford and to the great good fortune of having Lisa answer the posting last year for someone to lead the project.
Mark, let me follow up on something in terms of Cisco. You guys are at the forefront of what's now become legal operations before there was such a term as legal operations. I think Steve Harmon was probably one of the first true legal ops folks hired in corporate America under your guidance. What was it that you saw, or was it just the common sense point you were making earlier? What was it that you saw about the need to simplify and organize the operations of the business in a way that's become legal ops now?
Well, to emphasize the point I made earlier, Steve was a tremendous leader of the legal operations team at Cisco and obviously has had a global impact in that space. And so Steve had a background as an electrical engineer and then became a lawyer and could see both sides of how to do things better and faster and cheaper and has just had a fabulous career doing that at Cisco and now in a senior role at Elevate. For me, it was a matter of the fact that the company was growing very, very quickly in the late 90s and through the turn of the century. And we were doing a lot of things that it seemed obvious you could do better. I mean, we had operations in dozens of countries and we had annual meetings and minutes of meetings and you needed to find them. And how did you find the minutes of the, you know, 1994 annual meeting of the Belgian subsidiary if you needed them for some filing? Well, the answer is you put them all into PDF form and you put them on a site where you could access them. It wasn't hard. I mean, people were doing that kind of thing all over the place, just not in the legal world. We were signing non-disclosure agreements by the thousands, which we needed to keep track of. Why were we doing them with multi-part forms where the goldenrod copy went one place and the pink copy went another place and you had these envelopes with little strings on them and they had to be circulated to get signed? Why didn't we just make that something that you could sign electronically? So we did that. And we just started attacking every single thing we were doing and say, is there a way to do this better using tools that are already out there? So it was really driven by the factor of the growth that we were seeing and the fact we weren't going to be able to hire enough people to do all those manual processes. And also, frankly, internally, great leadership from John Chambers, who was the CEO of Cisco at the time, who said, you know, we're selling this stuff all over the world. I want you to figure out how to show that the legal world can do this too. And he gave me the budget and the authority to go out and implement these things. But it was a pretty natural evolution when you sat back and thought about it for a second.
Let me bring it back to the filing fairness project. What's next for the project? You've made great headway and you'll continue to move forward in that respect. But is there a next phase, or are you in the implementation, the hard work of rolling up your sleeves and getting it to work now?
I would say yes. And so, you know, we're incredibly excited to work with 7 courts now that have signed on to be filing fairness partners and adding more as they learn about our work, really to implement the court modernization toolkit. The courts that we're partnering with, they really understand the importance of providing court users with the tools that they need to effectively interact with the courts, and they're ready to move forward in their journey. So part of, you know, what we're doing is we're strategizing and figuring out what those paths look like with an eye toward multi-jurisdictional solutions. And with the appropriate funding, we know the courts will be able to meet this challenge. We're excited to be a part of it. And we're also working with the Los Angeles Superior Court. Mark, do you want to talk a little about that?
Sure. In LA, there's two very visionary leaders, Judge Samantha Jessner, who's the chief judge of the Superior Court, and David Slayton, who previously worked in the Texas judiciary and also at National Center for State Courts. And they heard what we were doing and said, why don't we team very closely with you, help you get the data to analyze what's working and what's not. They have 140 different tools people have built to help people do their work, but none of them are being used very much. And so Judge Jessner and David Slayton said, why don't we figure out why they're not being used and what the path is that we can follow to help make this work better. And that's a court that has 9.8 million people within its jurisdiction, bigger than 40 states. So that's a great partner to have in this. And it's a great pleasure to work with them and working in a way that will be durable and sustainable and maintainable over time, not just a one-shot deal. So we're very excited about that one, where we have the close partnership with Los Angeles.
That's fabulous. We'll put in the show notes links to the Rohde Center and to Filing Fairness Project. But if folks, I assume, and Lisa made the point about funders, so financial support is always important for efforts like this. If there are folks listening who want to contribute or want to help, where do they connect?
Well, I'd say go to the Rohde Center site and you'll see contact information on the Filing Fairness Project and the toolkit that's associated with that. We think that folks who are doing general funding of court improvements, including Legal Services Corporation, for example, which does have technology grants, will help legal services organizations that want to work with the courts to build sustainable tools. And I would go one step beyond that and say, well, also there's a government effort in the General Services Administration at the federal level to build tools that can be used by state and federal governments to improve processes in the legal system and in the benefit system. We're very optimistic about the work of 10X. Suffolk Law School has a wonderful project called the Litigation Lab, where they are working to build document assembly tools and integrate with e-filing systems. And, you know, you have folks out there who are building court technology in the private sector who I think haven't attacked this problem because of the lack of scalability. And we're hopeful that when they see what's being done for courts to work together, they'll say, aha, there's an opportunity to do for courts what TurboTax has done for tax filing. So we look at that and we see a wide variety of approaches, and we urge anybody that's excited about this to go look at those links in the program notes and get in touch with us, and we can help show them a path to making a difference.
Well, you guys are certainly making a huge difference. Congratulations and good luck as going forward. And Mark and Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciated the conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to Pioneers and Pathfinders. Be sure to visit thepioneerpodcast.com for show notes and more episodes. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform.